Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Over the past two decades, advances in immunotherapy and chimeric antigen receptor T cells, or CAR T therapy, have changed the way providers treat many cancer types. While these treatment advances have benefited patient outcomes, they may potentially come with acute and long-term adverse events. Regardless of practice setting, clinicians need to be aware of these potential toxicities and know how to manage them. Dr. Victoria Milano, a former pharmacy resident at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, discusses an evidence-based approach to the management of immunotherapy and CAR T toxicities.
In the last 10 to 20 years, immunotherapy has changed the way we treat cancers. Patients with a once detrimental cancer diagnosis now have a potential option to treat their cancers. But with these new immunotherapy agents come adverse events that are unique from our traditional chemotherapy adverse events. These patients can experience adverse events after just a single dose of immunotherapy, and it can be delayed from even months to years after receiving immunotherapy. Because of this, patients can present to a variety of settings, including inpatient, outpatient, and any number of floors outside of our hematology and oncology floors. For this reason, as clinicians and pharmacists, it's important that we know how to recognize and treat adverse events caused by immunotherapy agents. Today, I'll be describing the mechanism of immune checkpoint inhibitor and CAR T cell therapy toxicities, review the most common types of toxicities and risk factors associated with immunotherapy treatment, and discuss literature and guideline recommendations for the management of immunotherapy toxicities. Immunotherapy has been around for more than 100 years. Starting in 1890, Colley's toxins were invented by William Colley, who's coined the father of immunotherapy. And he discovered these toxins when he injected bacteria into patients with cancer and discovered that these cured patients' cancers. Following this, in the early 1900s, we had radiation therapy and traditional chemotherapy take over as the mainstay of therapy for cancer. And then in 1975, we had the invention of monoclonal antibodies, followed in 1997 by our first monoclonal antibody, rituximab, which was FDA approved. Then in 2002, CAR T cells were developed. We now have two CAR T cell products that are FDA approved, and they're approved for a number of different indications, including things like primary mediastinal large B-cell lymphoma, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. In 2011 is when our first checkpoint inhibitor came on the market, which is ipilimumab. And since this time, we've had a number of other checkpoint inhibitors that are approved. And they're approved for a number of indications, including malignant melanoma, hepatocellular carcinoma, renal cell carcinoma, non-small cell lung cancer, and Hodgkin's lymphoma. Immunotherapy is using an individual's immune system to fight cancer, and there are a number of different agents that fall under this class, including things like monoclonal antibodies and cancer vaccines. But for today's presentation, I will be focusing specifically on our newest immunotherapy agents, our immune checkpoint inhibitors, and our T-cell transfer therapies. To review just our basic immunology to discover our mechanism of how these agents work, I first just want to give this brief overview. So in our body, we have a number of different cells that can serve as antigen-presenting cells, and even a tumor can be an antigen-presenting cell by presenting some type of antigen. And when this receptor, the major histocompatibility complex, or MHC, interacts with the T-cell receptor on a T-cell, this activates our immune system to go and fight off these other antigen-presenting cells. Now, along with this, we can also have both a co-stimulatory or co-inhibitory factor as well. So the co-stimulatory would be like gas and activate further this T-cell, or the co-inhibitory acts as a brake, inhibiting the T-cell and immune system from being activated. Now, when it comes to our checkpoint inhibitors, without immunotherapy, we can see this antigen-presenting cell here, which could be, for example, a tumor. And our tumor or cancers are smart in that they have one of those co-inhibitory signals, which is the CD80/86 and CTLA-4 connection, or that interaction. And when this interaction occurs, our immune system is not activated, so we have inactivation of our T cell. Thus, our immune system does not recognize tumors as foreign, and tumors are allowed to continue to grow. But with our immunotherapy or checkpoint inhibitors, specifically this one here is our CTLA-4 inhibitors or ipilimumab. It works as an anti-CTLA-4 antibody, so it binds to that CTLA-4 receptor. Thus, it inhibits the break on the immune system, allowing the immune system to become activated, and our activated T cell can then go and fight off cancer. Additionally, we have two other classes of drugs within the checkpoint inhibitors, which are the PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors. Similarly to the CTLA-4 inhibitors, a tumor here is smart and it has this co-inhibitory signal through the PD-L1, PD-L2, and PD-1 interaction. So our tumor is allowed to continue to grow. But with our checkpoint inhibitors, so here are anti-PD-L1 antibodies and anti-PD-1 antibodies, they bind these specific receptors, allowing activation of our T cell, which can then go and fight off tumor cells. Some examples of medications in these classes, for the PD-1 inhibitors are drugs like nivolumab and pembrolizumab, and our PD-L1 inhibitors are drugs like atezolizumab. The original efficacy trials for our checkpoint inhibitors, first checkpoint inhibitor on the market, ipilimumab, was looking at patients with melanoma. And this trial here looked at patients that had unresectable stage 3 or 4 melanoma, and they were tested or given ipilimumab plus GP100, which is a cancer vaccine, versus just the GP100 alone. And what they found was that for overall survival rates at 24 months, patients in the ipilimumab groups, in their overall survival at 24 months was 24% compared to the GP100 group alone, which was 14%. Prior to this trial, there were no agents that had shown efficacy in melanoma. And of the 66,000 cancer deaths that occur every year, 80% were due to melanoma. And with this trial, they showed that patients in the ipilimumab group survived out to even 4.5 years after their melanoma diagnosis, which up to this time frame, patients had only, their median age of survival after a diagnosis of melanoma was only 1 year. And as further checkpoint inhibitors have come on the market, they've continued to show promising overall survival rates. Specifically with our newest combination immunotherapy treatments, we now are increasing surviving patient proportions even more. Now these are predicted response rates because we really don't have great long-term data at this point, but based on the initial trials that got the checkpoint inhibitors approved, these are the predicted response rates of what survival rates will continue to be. With all of these great efficacy that we've shown with our new immunotherapy agents, unfortunately they come with unique adverse events. So specifically for our checkpoint inhibitors, our immune checkpoint blockade agents, they cause an immune-related adverse event, which is an autoimmune-like adverse event. And then the second half of this presentation that I'll be focusing is our CAR T-cell immunotherapy toxicities. And CAR T-cells are known to cause both cytokine release syndrome and neurologic adverse events or toxicities. And this is due to both cytokine release as well as T-cell migration to the CNS. With traditional chemotherapy, we typically think of adverse events like nausea and vomiting, mucositis, and hair loss. And this is because our traditional chemotherapy is targeting our rapidly dividing cells. With immune checkpoint inhibitors, they have an immune-related adverse event by activating our immune system, so we can get adverse events with essentially any organ system. The ones that I have in red are the ones I will be discussing today, as they're the ones we're most likely to see in an inpatient and ICU setting, and the ones that have the most literature to support their treatment. Keep in mind that checkpoint inhibitors affect organ systems differently, so depending on the checkpoint inhibitor they're exposed to could affect what agent is affected or what organ system is affected. There are great guidelines in place for immune checkpoint inhibitor adverse event management, including the ASCO guidelines or American Society of Clinical Oncology. There's also European guidelines for managing immune checkpoint inhibitors. And in general, we grade our adverse events from grade 1 to grade 4, with grade 1 being the least severe and grade 4 being the most severe. Grade 1 in general, we just treat symptomatically. Grade 2, we often suspend our immunotherapy and start oral corticosteroids. And then grades 3 and 4, we're considering using IV corticosteroids, consulting specialists in the organ affected, and even using alternative immunosuppressive therapy if corticosteroids are not sufficient. The one exception to this rule is our endocrinopathies, which we treat with replacement therapy. The first adverse event that I want to discuss is the gastrointestinal. And this is the second most common immune-related adverse event after skin toxicities. It occurs in about 20% of all patients that are treated with a checkpoint inhibitor. And we often are ruling out other things that could lead to this, the signs and symptoms of a gastrointestinal effect. So things like C. diff or CMV viremia. And how we're looking at these patients is by an increase in stool frequency to diagnose. We most likely see gastrointestinal adverse events around 5 to 10 weeks after starting a checkpoint inhibitor, and the most likely agents to cause these adverse events are anti-CTLA-4 agents or ipilimumab, or treatment with combination checkpoint inhibitors. We treat with prednisone or methylprednisolone 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day. And the evidence for this is very, very weak. It actually, there's no prospective clinical trials that have looked at dose of steroid that we should use or type of steroid. It all actually comes from the initial checkpoint inhibitor trials where it was just based on protocol and expert opinion. I think what's often a misconception is that providers and pharmacists will think that we need to treat with very high steroid doses, like 500 milligrams to a gram of methylprednisolone, and this is not the case. We can treat with low doses, 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram, so about 75 to 200 milligrams a day. If steroids are not efficacious or patients continue to have refractory gastrointestinal symptoms, there is some evidence for using agents like infliximab or vedolizumab. Infliximab is a TNF-alpha inhibitor, which is one of the cytokines that's released through an activated T cell when our immune system is activated. And normally these cytokines cause damage to our epithelial cells, so when infliximab can inhibit one of the cytokines, it prevents or maintains our epithelial cells in our intestinal barrier. The evidence for infliximab with enterocolitis is a small case series of 5 patients that were given steroid-dependent or had steroid-dependent or partially refractory enterocolitis, and they were treated with infliximab 5 milligrams per kilogram every 2 weeks for 1 to 2 doses. And they noted in this case series that all 5 of the patients had resolution of their symptoms within 2 to 3 days. Unfortunately, with infliximab, there are a few concerns. One is highly immunosuppressive, so we worry about infection risk, and it's recommended that patients are up to date on their vaccinations. And then there's also some concern that it may worsen tumor growth, as it is an immune system, immunosuppressive agent. So it's inhibiting our immune system from fighting cancer elsewhere in our body. Additionally, at Mayo, we commonly use etanercept because it is cheaper and it works very similarly in mechanism of action to infliximab. Now, the other agent that we can consider using is vedolizumab. It specifically binds to the alpha-4 beta-7 subunit on a specific subset of CD4 T cells that are only present in the GI system. So again, it's inhibiting the activated T cell from releasing these cytokines and causing damage on the epithelial cells, but it's restricted solely to the GI tract, so it's less systemic compared to infliximab. The evidence for vedolizumab, again, is just a small case series looking at 7 patients that had ipilimumab or nivolumab-induced enterocolitis and had steroid-dependent or partially refractory disease. They were given vedolizumab as a 300-milligram infusion at 0, 2, and 6 weeks, and they noted 6 of their 7 patients that they treated achieved steroid-free enterocolitis remission at a median of 56 days after starting vedolizumab. The next immune-related adverse event that I want to discuss is our pulmonary. Here again, the incidence is very rare, about 2% of all patients treated with checkpoint inhibitors, and we're concurrently ruling out other things that could lead to these pulmonary adverse events, like infections. How we look or find these criteria is an increase in oxygen requirement and radiographic evidence. We most likely see pulmonary adverse events around 3 months after starting checkpoint inhibitors. This is one of the adverse events that's the most delayed in onset, but it can occur earlier, anywhere between 2 to 24 months. And again, these adverse events can occur after even just a single dose of a checkpoint inhibitor. The most likely agents to cause our pulmonary immune-related adverse events are our PD-1 agents like nivolumab and pembrolizumab and combination therapy. Here, we treat with steroids 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day. There's also small evidence for infliximab, mycophenolate, IVIG, or cyclophosphamide. Renal is another immune-related adverse event that I want to discuss. Again, is very rare, about 2% of all patients treated with checkpoint inhibitors, although there's some literature that it may be underestimated just because there may not be elevations in creatinine. It may just be more minor renal damage. We look at serum creatinine as our laboratory marker for diagnosing renal adverse events, and we most likely see it 90 days after starting a checkpoint inhibitors, but again, can be sooner or more delayed. Most likely agents to cause renal adverse events are treatment with combination checkpoint inhibitors, and we treat with steroids, prednisone, 0.5 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day, or potentially mycophenolate. If you recall, endocrine is the one disorder where we treat uniquely from the rest of our immune-related adverse event, as we're treating with hormone replacement therapy and not necessarily steroids. Endocrine disorders, we look for our typical signs and symptoms that you would expect from an endocrine disorder, as well as laboratory markers like TSH, free T4, ACTH, or ketosis in urine. We most commonly see endocrine disorders 4 to 12 weeks after starting immune checkpoint inhibitors, and our most likely agents to cause this are ipilimumab for hypophysitis or pituitary disease, or anti-PD-1, PD-L1, are more closely linked to causing diabetes and thyroiditis. Again, here we treat with hormone replacement therapy specific to the endocrine disorder, and you can consider using steroids if it's truly a life-threatening or critical illness. And then cardiovascular is one of the most rare, but I would argue most significant if it were to occur. It occurs in less than 0.1% of all patients treated with checkpoint inhibitors. And we look at cardiac biomarkers like troponin or BNP, ECG, and echocardiograms. We most commonly see the cardiovascular adverse events 10 weeks after starting a checkpoint inhibitor, but again, can be sooner or more delayed. All agents have been linked with causing a cardiovascular adverse event, specifically myocarditis and pericarditis. There's not necessarily one agent that's more closely linked. Treatment here is unique from the other immune-related adverse events I've discussed, in that we hold the checkpoint inhibitor. With other adverse events, we may continue treatment with the checkpoint inhibitor, but here you're holding and you permanently discontinue if the symptoms progress beyond grade 1. We treat with steroids, methylprednisolone, 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day, and this is the one indication where you could potentially increase your steroid dose up to a gram. And if patients don't improve quickly within 24 hours, you want to be thinking about adding other immunosuppressive treatment like mycophenolate, infliximab, or IVIG. There is some evidence within the cardiovascular adverse event for comparing steroid doses. This comes from a 35-patient, 8-center institutional registry of patients that had immune checkpoint inhibitor-associated myocarditis, of which about 40% developed a major adverse cardiac event, which was defined as cardiovascular death, cardiogenic shock, or cardiac arrest. And they found that in those that had a major adverse cardiac event, they were started on lower steroid doses up front, about 0.84 milligrams per kilogram, compared to those that did not develop a major adverse cardiac event, which were started on about 2 milligrams per kilogram of steroid up front. So this is the one adverse event, cardiovascular, where you could argue for treating with higher steroid doses up front. So my first question for the audience, if you can pull out your phones or on your computer, you can respond at pollev.com/MayoRx, or you can text in all caps MayoRx to 22333 and then answer texting either A, B, C, or D. So the first question is, which of the following immune-related adverse events should not be treated with steroids? A, adrenal insufficiency, B, pneumonitis, C, hyperthyroidism, or D, myocarditis? So I agree with the majority of responses in the audience. Hyperthyroidism is the correct answer here. For adrenal insufficiency, our replacement therapy, it's an endocrine disorder, but we treat with steroids for replacement therapy. Pneumonitis, we do treat with steroids. Hyperthyroidism, we would not treat with steroids up front. And myocarditis, we would treat with steroids. So C is the correct answer. So in summary, for our checkpoint inhibitor toxicities, we treat with steroids, prednisone or methylprednisolone, 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day. Again, the evidence for the choice of steroid to use or the dose of steroid is very limited and just comes from the initial checkpoint inhibitor trials based on expert opinion and protocol. We don't treat necessarily with really high doses, though. We're limiting to 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day. Often these adverse events are a diagnosis of exclusion, so we're working patients up concurrently for infection, so they're often receiving antibiotics concurrently until we can rule that out. We should consider giving prophylaxis to everyone that we treat because these patients are on steroid tapers for a prolonged period of time, over nearly 4 to 6 weeks, so all patients should be given prophylaxis. The guidelines do actually point out a case report of a 48-year-old male who was treated with ipilimumab-induced colitis. He was given infliximab and high-dose steroids for the colitis, and a month later diagnosed with Aspergillus fumigatus pneumonia. And this does just call into question as a reminder for everyone that we should treat with PCP prophylaxis for anyone that we're sending out with a prolonged course of steroids. Oftentimes, these patients are getting a prescription for steroids, and we're sending them outpatient to continue their taper, so it's unclear how long they will be on steroids for. So PCP prophylaxis is something to definitely consider. And the guidelines also mentioned to consider prophylactic fluconazole, although again, there's really no great evidence for this, and it's not a practice that we routinely do here at Mayo Clinic. Risk factors for checkpoint inhibitor toxicities include things like baseline autoimmune diseases. And actually, patients with autoimmune disorders were excluded from the initial checkpoint inhibitor trials. But since the initial checkpoint inhibitors were approved, we now have some evidence for using our checkpoint inhibitors in patients with autoimmune disorders. And this comes from a 52-patient study looking at patients with advanced melanoma and pre-existing autoimmune disorders who were treated with anti-PD-1 antibodies. And they looked at the flare of autoimmune disorder in these patients. At the start of this trial, majority of patients did not have a clinically active autoimmune disease, and the majority of patients were not on any immunosuppression for their autoimmune disease. But after receiving anti-PD-1 antibodies, about 40% of all patients did have a flare of their autoimmune disorder. So having an autoimmune disorder and receiving a checkpoint inhibitor does put you at higher risk of having a flare of that autoimmune disorder. In addition to baseline autoimmune diseases, other risk factors for checkpoint inhibitor toxicities include things like chronic organ dysfunction, chronic viral infection, and organ transplant as well. And again, this is because your immune system is already at a higher risk for experiencing these adverse events. The next question that is often asked is, does treatment with immunosuppressing agents affect our efficacy of our checkpoint inhibitors? If you recall, our checkpoint inhibitor's mechanism of action is activating our immune system to fight cancer. So if we're treating with these immunosuppressive agents, does that affect our efficacy of these checkpoint inhibitors? And there are a few studies that have looked at this question. This one here is a retrospective analysis of 576 patients that had advanced melanoma. They received at least one dose of nivolumab, and of these patients, 114 received systemic immunomodulating agents, all received corticosteroids, and three additionally received mycophenolate or infliximab, and then 462 were compared to these 114 who did not receive any systemic immunomodulating agents. And what they looked at overall was the impact of systemic immunomodulating agents on tumor response rate. And what they found was in those that received immune modulating agents, about 30% achieved a response on their tumor or had efficacy still of their checkpoint inhibitors, compared to those that did not receive any immunosuppressing agents. Similarly, about 30% achieved a response in their tumor rate. So it seems promising that treatment with immunosuppression does not appear to affect our efficacy of our checkpoint inhibitors. Although again, this is early on after receiving immunosuppression, so it's hard to say. Another trial similarly looked at this question and asked, does systemic corticosteroid treatment affect overall survival? This was a retrospective analysis of 298 patients with melanoma who received at least one dose of ipilimumab, 103 patients who received systemic corticosteroids for an immune-related adverse event were compared to 195 patients who did not receive any systemic corticosteroids, and they looked at the impact of systemic immunosuppression on overall survival. Here again, they found that those in the blue who did not receive any steroids had similar overall survival rates to those that did receive steroids. Again, not a statistically significant effect. So it appears, again, promising that our immunosuppression does not appear to affect our checkpoint inhibitor efficacy. And then the last question that's often asked is it safe? When is it safe, and is it safe to resume a checkpoint inhibitor if someone experiences an adverse event? This study was a cohort study of 93 patients who had a checkpoint inhibitor immune-related adverse event, and they rechallenged about 40% of patients with a checkpoint inhibitor, and about half of those rechallenged group did experience an immune-related adverse event, with the majority being a same immune-related adverse event and about 13% being a different adverse event. So I would say that you can consider rechallenging with a checkpoint inhibitor if patients' symptoms and labs do improve to grade 1 or less. Just keep in mind they are at high risk, though, of having a flare of an immune-related adverse event again. And if patients experience a grade 4 adverse event, or I would argue if they present to the ICU for treatment of their immune-related adverse event, you should consider permanently discontinuing the checkpoint inhibitor. There is a warning flag in EPIC, which is nice for all of our reference. It's under an FYI immune checkpoint inhibitor. Thanks to Hillary, the informatics resident, for getting this for me. And just keep in mind that even patients that have received one dose of an immune checkpoint inhibitor are at risk, and it can be delayed even out to years. So keep in mind that this should be on your differential if a patient has ever received an immune checkpoint inhibitor before. So my next question for the audience, you can take out your computers and respond at pollev.com/mayorx. Which of the following is a risk factor for checkpoint inhibitor toxicity? A, baseline autoimmune disease, B, acute organ failure, C, increased age, or D, poor performance status? So I agree with the majority of the audience here. Baseline autoimmune disease is a risk factor for checkpoint inhibitor toxicity. Acute organ failure is not necessarily, but chronic organ failure has been associated as a risk factor. Neither increased age nor poor performance status have been linked with being a risk factor for checkpoint inhibitor toxicity. Now, for the next portion of this presentation, I want to focus on CAR T cell therapy toxicities. So if you recall this picture from the beginning of the lecture, again, we have just our review of immunology. So we have our antigen-presenting cell that has the MHC interaction with the TCR to activate our immune system, or our T cell. And then we can also have those co-stimulatory or gas essentially on our immune system, or the co-inhibitory or brakes on our immune system. So our checkpoint inhibitors were working on the co-inhibitory side. Now our CAR T cell therapies focus on that co-stimulatory signal, or the gas. To give just a broad overview of CAR T cell therapy, this works by removing T cells from a patient's blood. Then we genetically alter the T cells in a lab to contain certain proteins. And these proteins specifically are either A41BB or CD28, which are two co-stimulatory signals. So there are two FDA-approved CAR T cell products on the market. Each one works on each one of these co-stimulatory signals. Then after adding these to the T cell, we inject the T cells back into a patient after we precondition the patient with chemotherapy. And then these modified proteins help the immune cells to both find and kill cancer cells that express these receptors. The two most common toxicities with CAR T cell therapies are cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity. The pathophysiology for cytokine release syndrome consists of activation and expansion of our CAR T cells, leading to lysis of both normal and tumor cells. And this causes release of several cytokines, including interferon gamma and tumor necrosis factor alpha, which then trigger the activation of monocytes and macrophages that have enhanced tumoricidal capacity. These activated macrophages secrete high levels of pro-inflammatory cytokines and inducible nitric oxide synthase. And if you look at this pathophysiology, it looks very similar in the pathophysiology behind sepsis and septic shock. Our incidence of cytokine release syndrome is about 57 to 93% for prediction rates, and it most commonly occurs 2 to 3 days after receiving CAR T cell therapy, but can occur even up to 3 weeks. Risk factors include having a higher burden malignancy and receiving higher CAR T cell doses. And signs and symptoms consist of a prodromal phase followed by a secondary phase of pyrexia, hemodynamic instability, and organ dysfunction. And again, these signs and symptoms look very similarly to sepsis or septic shock. So oftentimes these patients are being treated with antibiotics for septic shock until we can rule that out. There are a number of different consensus diagnosis guidelines for cytokine release syndrome, including the UPenn and Lee criteria, but the most recently accepted and established criteria are the American Society for Transplantation and Cellular Therapy consensus diagnosis. And they grade cytokine release syndrome from grade 1 with just a fever. Grade 2 is hypotension not requiring vasopressors, or hypoxia requiring less than or equal to 6 liters a minute of oxygen. Grade 3 is hypotension requiring a vasopressor, or hypoxia requiring more than 6 liters a minute of oxygen. And then grade 4 is hypotension requiring multiple vasopressors or hypoxia requiring positive pressure ventilation. And again, similar to sepsis and septic shock, this grading system looks very similarly. Our current management for cytokine release syndrome consists of standard supportive therapies. Oftentimes, again, these patients are receiving antibiotics until we can rule out an infection that could be causing this, what looks like sepsis or septic shock. And we can treat cytokine release syndrome with tocilizumab, which is an interleukin-6 receptor antagonist. And we dose this at 8 milligrams per kilogram every 8 hours, up to 3 doses, specifically for our Mayo protocol. And each dose of tocilizumab is followed by a dose of dexamethasone of 10 milligrams oral or IV. And if patients don't improve quickly with this regimen, we can escalate our steroids up to methylprednisolone, even up to 1 gram IV daily. Our algorithm for treating cytokine release syndrome, specifically here at Mayo Clinic, for grade 1, which is just that fever, we treat with aggressive supportive care. Grade 2, which is a fever or hypotension not requiring vasopressors, or hypoxia requiring low-flow nasal cannula, we treat with aggressive supportive care and consider tocilizumab if patients clinically worsen or do not improve. And there is some evidence for using, or there is ongoing trials looking at using tocilizumab early versus later. So there's more to come on that in the future. And then grade 3 and 4, which would be a fever or hypotension requiring vasopressors or hypoxia requiring high flow nasal cannula or mechanical ventilation, we're treating with tocilizumab plus or minus corticosteroids. Tocilizumab is an interleukin-6 receptor antagonist. So interleukin-6 is one of the cytokines that is released by our immune system in an activated T cell. So this inhibits the cytokines from binding to the receptor and causing their effect on a target cell. The FDA approval for tocilizumab actually comes from a retrospective analysis of pooled data from the prospective clinical trials of the initial CAR T cell therapy studies. Patients were treated with tocilizumab if they had severe cytokine release syndrome or grade 3 or 4 cytokine release syndrome, and they were given IV tocilizumab as an 8 mg/kg dose. 45 of the patients initially received Kymriah, which is one of the CAR T cell therapy products on the market, and the other 15 received Yescarta. So these are the two FDA approved CAR T cell products that we have. There's many more in development, including one that's actively being studied at Mayo Clinic as well. The primary outcome in this tocilizumab trial was looking at characterizing the resolution of cytokine release syndrome, and the resolution was defined as being afebrile and off vasopressors for at least 24 hours. In this trial, the majority of patients, or all patients in the Kymriah group, had acute lymphoblastic leukemia as their underlying malignancy. In the Yescarta group, majority of patients had diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. All patients, again, had severe cytokine release syndrome or grade 3 or 4 cytokine release syndrome. And about half of patients received tocilizumab in the first 4 days after the onset of cytokine release syndrome, and about half received tocilizumab more than 4 days after the start of their cytokine release syndrome. And majority of patients did just receive a single dose of tocilizumab. They found that in the Kymriah group, about 70% of patients had resolution of their cytokine release syndrome by day 14. Again, resolution was defined as being afebrile and off vasopressors for at least 24 hours. And in the Yescarta group, about 53% of patients experienced resolution by day 14 of their cytokine release syndrome. Similarly to checkpoint inhibitors, there's concern that when we treat with immunosuppression, that may affect our efficacy of our CAR T cell therapies. And this is a very small study. It only consisted of 6 patients, and they were looking at the number of CAR T cells that were remaining in bone marrow cells up to 6 weeks after receiving their CAR T cell therapy infusion. And what you can see here is that those that did not have any cytokine release syndrome had about the same number of cells remaining as those that had severe cytokine release syndrome that was treated with steroids. As opposed to those that had severe cytokine release syndrome that was not treated with steroids, they had a greater number of CAR T cells remaining in their bone marrow cells. Now, again, this is a very small study, and you cannot extrapolate it to true efficacy trials at this point because it was purely looking at just number of cells remaining. And there have been studies since that have shown that immunosuppression does not appear to affect our CAR T cell therapy efficacy. So at this point, it's somewhat controversial, but this was just a small study that did have some interesting findings. The next adverse event or toxicity that we can see with CAR T cell therapy is neurotoxicity. And the pathophysiology is not completely well understood, but it's hypothesized that when we have our CAR T cell therapy infusion, this causes release of a number of cytokines like tumor necrosis factor alpha and interferon gamma that can cross our blood-brain barrier and activate macrophages and monocytes to secrete other cytokines, including interleukin 1, 6, and 10, that can then cause inflammation in our neurons, leading to this neurotoxicity pathophysiology. The incidence of neurotoxicity ranges anywhere between 0 to 87% in studies and occurs in onset of 4 to 6 days most commonly after receiving CAR T cell therapy. It does often occur concurrently with cytokine release syndrome, although it is its own unique pathophysiology and it does not have to occur with cytokine release syndrome. The signs and symptoms are neurologic effects that you would expect, like headache, pain, dizziness, movement disorders, which can often be profound. One of the diagnostic criteria is to have patients write a statement, and they often think they are writing clearly, but it is obviously very impaired writing. And then patients can also present with severe symptoms such as seizures. To diagnose neurotoxicity, we use what's called an ICE scoring system, and we have patients complete these tasks, including orientation, naming, to follow commands, to write, and their attention. And then we total up this score to a maximum of 10 points and add this to other clinical signs and symptoms in the ICANS syndrome, and then grade our neurotoxicity from grade 1 to grade 4, with grade 1 being the least severe and grade 4 being the most severe. Our management of neurotoxicity includes using dexamethasone. This is because it crosses the blood-brain barrier. So we use 10 milligrams IV every 6 hours until patients regress back down to grade 1 neurotoxicity, and then we taper rapidly over 3 days. With neurotoxicity, tocilizumab is not helpful and may actually make neurotoxicity worse. And this is because tocilizumab does not cross the blood-brain barrier. And if you recall, it's an interleukin-6 receptor antagonist. So by inhibiting the receptors peripherally, there may be more interleukin-6 that's able to freely cross the blood-brain barrier and cause more inflammation. Similarly to our checkpoint inhibitors, we do have a nice warning flag in EPIC. When patients or when prescribers order corticosteroids for patients that have received CAR T-cell therapies in the past, there is a nice warning flag just to recommend that you discuss this with the CAR T therapy team or the BMT service before using corticosteroids with CAR T-cells. So my last question for the audience is, we have a 55-year-old patient who is presenting with neurotoxicity after receiving CAR T-cell infusion 5 days prior. What should be started first? A, tocilizumab, B, dexamethasone, C, hydrocortisone, or D, infliximab? So I agree with the audience. Dexamethasone is the correct choice here. Tocilizumab does not work and may actually be harmful in neurotoxicity. Dexamethasone is our agent of choice because it does cross the blood-brain barrier. Hydrocortisone has not been used at this point, nor has infliximab. So in summary, our immune-related adverse events are common from checkpoint inhibitors. We treat these immune-related adverse events with prednisone or methylprednisolone, 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day, for our more severe adverse events. And we do a slow taper to prevent reoccurrence. Cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity are the two most common toxicities or adverse events that we see after patients received CAR T-cell therapies. And we treat severe cytokine release syndrome with tocilizumab plus or minus corticosteroids, and we treat severe neurotoxicity with corticosteroids.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.